Well, Needham has a section on the German Empire and feudalism, and this becomes important, I think, for understanding later something about the Crusades, so let me mention it a little bit. Feudalism was a political system in which local lords gave protection to tenants in exchange for an oath of loyalty. And that oath of loyalty included an agreement to fight under the lord, who was the owner of the land, when they were ordered to do that. And so there came to be a chain of loyalty, and there were greater and lesser feudal lords, and there was a kind of chain of loyalty that developed out of that. And one factor that becomes very important for later on and into the history in Scotland that's behind our own church is that the local lord, who was the landowner, would build the church for his people, the sharecroppers, we might call them, who lived on his land. And then he would feel, as the one who was really the ruler of that little kingdom, it might be quite small, he felt that he had the privilege of naming the pastor or the priest of the church. And this is the origin of the practice that later came to be called patronage, which was a big deal in Scotland. And there were at least two splits in the Church of Scotland, the first to form the Seceders, and the second to form the Free Church of Scotland, in which patronage was a big issue. There were in a parish, there was a hereditary tradition that the squire of the parish would be the one to pick the pastor. And usually he was a wealthy and powerful man, and he wouldn't want a pastor that would have too much to say against wealth and power, and often would choose to have a kind of a time-serving pastor who didn't really preach the gospel. And so on those two occasions, it led to splits in the Church of Scotland. But the roots of it are in the feudal system. And it's in this time that the Holy Roman Empire as a Western entity really gets established. Otto the Great, who was from Middle Europe, what's now Germany, defeated the Magyars in Hungary and the Norsemen and the Slavs and rescued papal lands from the Lombards. And in exchange for that, he was crowned Holy Roman Emperor by Pope John the 22nd in 962. And so from then on, you have this Holy Roman Emperor with relations, sometimes close allies, sometimes enemies, with the papacy. And Otto made use of many bishops in his government because they were well-educated and because they had no legitimate children to inherit their position. Many of them had illegitimate children, but they didn't have legitimate children. And so the emperor would be able to name other people of his choice and not have the position be hereditary. So that's briefly about the German Empire and feudalism. Section 3 is the Cluniac Revival, and you may be rather startled by the word revival, not like Jonathan Edwards' revival or a Great Awakening or something like that, but a kind of renewal centered in the monastic movement and in the monastery at Cluny, located in southeast France. That monastery was founded in 909 A.D., and then greatly expanded later till there were 1,000 monasteries under the control of the abbot of Cluny by 1100 A.D. And the thing that was new about this was to have many monasteries under one governing authority. a monastic order with a centralized power, and this became quite influential. The Benedictine rule was followed in these monasteries, and they were ultimately answerable only to the Pope. They had abbots in the monasteries, and then the main abbot at Cluny, but they were not under local bishops or secular rulers. They were finally under the authority of the Pope. They became an instrument then of papal power. And Needham says that the abbots of Cluny, rather than the popes, were the central figures on the Christian life of Western Europe, in the Christian life of Western Europe, until Hildebrand became pope in 1073. So that's a period of 150 years or so in which this the successive abbots of Cluny had great power. These monasteries often formed strong alliances with kings because kings would send their sons to the monasteries to be educated, and they would also take people trained in the monasteries to be their civil servants. These monasteries came to own great tracts of territory where the feudal system applied, and so there were a lot of potential soldiers coming from the lands owned by the monasteries. Now that really strikes you as something odd, doesn't it? You think of people going to the monasteries for contemplation and devotion and so forth. But they are landowners, and the people on their lands are obligated to go to war when the abbot of the monastery decides they will do that. So this is the church militant, in a way, than we sometimes use that term. There is not a clear line of popes from Peter to the present. And let me just make that sort of simplistic overstatement. But when you read this history, you find how complicated the history of the papacy is. And there are a number of occasions in which, at the same time, there is more than one pope. And some people have loyalty to one and some to another. I've looked in the Catholic Encyclopedia to try to get a handle on this, and the Catholic Encyclopedia does give sort of the Orthodox official list of the popes from Peter on, but then they also have a list that they call the anti-popes, which are the popes not recognized now by the church. But at the time when there was more than one pope, it was hard to figure out who was really the successor of Peter. And so it came to be that in 1066, there were three rival popes in Rome. And pretty complicated to understand how this came about. The first was Benedict the Ninth, and then he was deposed by the aristocracy in Rome, and in his place Sylvester II was named Pope, and then Benedict was restored to power, but Sylvester still claimed to be the right Pope. You can think here about maybe elections in Florida or something like that. It's that kind of confusion. Benedict sold the papacy to another man. He got tired of it, Gregory the Sixth, and then later decided, after all, he wanted to be pope. So all three of these at the same time were claiming to be the pope. And so what happened was that the pope, the emperor, stepped in and decided who was going to be recognized as the true pope. Well, here's one of the men who were involved in this controversy and advising the popes and so on was named Hildebrand, and he becomes a very powerful pope in 1073. So we move to Hildebrand and the investiture controversy. And I think I don't have in my notes, some of you may remember who the emperor was, maybe this comes later, who solved that controversy, but I'm recognizing that I don't have it here. Anyway, Hildebrand and the investiture controversy. Hildebrand was a monk who assisted Pope Leo IX in reforming the church. And in doing this, he heightened the claims made by the Pope as successor to Peter. And I wanted to give you that. It's on page 159 in the book. This is after Hildebrand became Pope, 1073, and he made these claims. The Roman Church was founded by God alone. Only the Roman Pope is rightly called universal. The Pope alone can depose and reinstate bishops. The Pope is the only one whose feet all princes may kiss, must kiss. The Pope may depose emperors. No council may be called ecumenical without the Pope's authority. The Pope may be judged by no one. The Roman Church has never erred, and as Scripture testifies, it never shall err to all eternity. I don't remember where the Scripture testifies that. I suppose they're thinking about, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. The Roman Pope, if properly ordained according to church law, is sanctified by the merits of St. Peter. He who is not in conformity with the Roman Church should not be considered a Catholic. Now, this is a selection of the claims that he made. Needham gives us the ones that are most important. Well, there was a practice at this time related to feudalism in which the ruler would, in the ceremony in which a bishop or an abbot was installed in his position, the civil ruler would give to him the symbols of his authority. And in seeking to extend his authority, Gregory the Seventh, Hildebrand has now become Gregory the Seventh, he forbade the Holy Roman Emperor to practice lay investiture, this ceremony that I've just talked about. Henry defied the Pope and appointed a new archbishop in Milan. And in fact, in doing that, called upon Gregory to resign from the papacy. Gregory responded by excommunicating Henry. And then the bishops in Henry's territory followed the lead of the Pope and withdrew their support from Henry. And that meant that he lost a lot of his military power because a lot of his soldiers came from lands controlled by the bishops. And so Henry was forced to capitulate, and he traveled to the city of Canossa, Italy. And the story is, it's in the light of our weather these last few days, I'm picturing this, it's hard to picture. Levi came out of the cold with his feet swollen yesterday. The story is, Henry IV stood 3 days in the snow, barefoot, before the palace where the Pope was staying, pleading for restoration. And the Pope was persuaded to grant that restoration. But later, in the changes that took place, Gregory again excommunicated Henry, And this time Henry responded in a less penitent way, because he invaded Italy and arrested Gregory, removed him from the papal throne, and placed Clement III as the pope. And then Henry III proceeded to crown Henry as the Holy Roman Emperor. And this led to a controversy that went on for about a generation. In about 1106, there was a meeting held at the city of Worms, where Luther later went and defended himself, a meeting between Pope Calixtus II and Henry V, the succeeding Holy Roman Emperor. And they came to a compromise which said the emperor would invest a bishop or an abbot with authority over his land, because bishops did control a lot of land, and the archbishop then would invest the bishop with the insignia of spiritual authority. So the bishop had both civil and religious authority, but got the symbol of that from two different people. There's a renewal in this time of controversy over communion. We'd had earlier Radbertus and Rotramnus. Radbertus holding to what's called the real presence of Christ in the sacrament, and Rotramnus having a more symbolic view of the Lord's Supper. This time it's Berengar of Tours and Lanfranc of Canterbury. And Berengar has the view of Radbertus, and Lanfranc that of Rotramnus, that is, the one, the real presence, the other, the more symbolic understanding of the Lord's Supper. And the views of Berengar here, I just crossed those two over. Let me go back to it again. Lanfranc had the more symbolic view of the Lord's Supper. Berengar had the view of the real presence. And under pressure from the Pope, Berengar recanted his views, and he signed a statement that said, after the consecration, no bread and wine was present, but were miraculously replaced by Christ's flesh and blood. And so this continues on into the Reformation, and as we said earlier, becomes a point of division between Lutherans and Reformed particularly. There's an ongoing discussion of this, really, in Reformed circles, even to the present day. And then from this chapter, I just wanted to mention two other things. One is the case of Thomas à Becket. And you may be familiar with this if you know the play or the movie A Man for All Seasons. We are not all the time traveling the world, but when we've traveled, it's memorable. And we got to see Charlton Heston once in London in the A Man for All Seasons. So it's quite a quite an impressive play. And it's about this story. William the Conqueror had established a two-fold court system in England. And this led to the fact that later only the clergy were only subject to ecclesiastical courts. If a priest committed murder, he would not be tried in a civil court, or he would be tried in an ecclesiastical court. And the punishments were much less severe in the ecclesiastical courts. They didn't have the death penalty. And this was a limitation on civil power and privileges of the clergy that was troubling to some. And Henry wanted to abolish this system and make the clergy subject to his courts, to the civil courts. And he was opposed strongly by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas à Becket. And the king was heard to say to some of his soldiers, I wish somebody would rid me of this priest, this troublesome priest. And the soldiers took him literally and murdered Thomas à Becket in the church. And for this, the Pope forced Henry II to do penance and to restore clerical immunity. And so the power of the Roman Church under the papacy is growing with regard to civil, with regard to the matter of administration of justice. And, you know, things keep on working like this. We think about the scandals about abuse of children by clergy. And in our time, there's been a lot of concern because the Catholic Church has tried to handle this in-house and not subject priests who were charged of these things to civil prosecution. And that's changing at the present time, but this sort of insulation of the clergy from the general society goes back to events like this. Then I wanted to just call your attention. This is something that Needham often does to the place of musical instruments in worship. And I've given you pretty much a summary in your notes of what Needham says about this. There are scattered references to the use of instruments in worship from the 8th century on. That would be from the 700s. Scattered references. In the period 900 to 1100, organs became commonplace in abbeys and cathedrals, but not in parish churches. So the monasteries and the cathedrals would have the resources to build organs that would be quite expensive in that day, and to employ musicians and so on. It was not done in the ordinary parish church worship. Instruments were not used in ordinary masses until the 12th century. Thomas Aquinas, in the 13th century, condemned the use of musical instruments in worship as being Jewish, being Old Testament kind of worship. But this difference between the East and the West in use of musical instruments served to sharpen further the difference between the Orthodox and the Catholics. Now let me pause there for a moment and give you opportunity for questions or comments. Well, we come last of all tonight to the Crusades, and this is a down note to end on. I'm sorry about that, but it's the way it comes in the course. I think myself that the time of the Crusades is about the lowest point after the time of Constantine. Great wickedness, great suffering, sponsored by the papacy and even by somebody like Bernard of Clairvaux. We'll talk about him. And it's hard to imagine the kind of misery and harm to the gospel that was done by the Crusades. Needham says, and you're quite aware of this these days when we think about Islamic fundamentalism and violence and so forth, well, they call us in the West crusaders, and they remember this history and the kind of Christian jihad, if we could say it that way, that went on against them in this period of history. So it's reality. We need to deal with it. Certainly was not, in my view, a positive advancement of the kingdom of Christ. It was a scandal for the gospel as I read this history. Needham says that the Crusades were military expeditions to the Middle East, inspired and blessed by the Catholic Church, with the aim of recapturing the Holy Land from the Muslims. A crusade had a religious motivation, that of washing away the crusaders' sins. And that was promised to them, as we'll see in something I'll read in a little bit. They were called crusaders because they bore the cross. And these days, I think it's pretty innocent, but in the political correct society, there is objection to people singing "Onward, Christian Soldiers." And the cross of Jesus going on before. Well, whoever wrote that hymn, I think, probably had some stories about the Crusades in the back of his mind. Meant a spiritual crusade that didn't mean bloodshed and so forth. But I would think when Muslims hear Christians singing that, they react probably in not a very positive way. There were four main crusades, others that came later, and I give you the dates there in the notes. I think I do. I have more extensive notes that I'm reading from. Did I give you the dates? Yeah, okay. Well, what brings about the crusades? Christians had been making pilgrimages to the Holy Land for a long time. And this is a part of the merit system, a way of gaining merit, a way of reducing time in purgatory, would be to make a pilgrimage to a holy place. I mentioned, I think, that the church in Wittenberg, where Luther posted his 95 Theses, had a very famous collection of relics, and people made pilgrimages to that church to get merit by making the pilgrimage and then by reciting prayers in the presence of the relics. So pilgrimage was, I hope, not like some of us making a trip to Scotland to see the graves of the martyrs. It gains us no merit. It's not for that purpose. And it was a deterioration from an honoring of the martyrs and wanting to remember where Jesus actually walked to saying, well, if you take the trouble to make the trip, then you will gain merit. So this had been going on. And I think this is an example, if I may say this, of bad theology leading to bad practice. You think that you gain salvation by some other way than the merit of Christ and by your own effort and so on, then it does have bad consequences in this life as well as not really preparing you for the life to come. There had been a time in which the Muslims controlling the Holy Land had been open to Christians coming and visiting and had treated them with some respect. But after the Turks took over after 1055, they began to harass Christian pilgrims. And it was a very difficult thing then. And so the time came when the Byzantine emperor appealed to Pope Urban II for military assistance in fighting the Turks. The Pope responded to this in part because he was involved in one of these situations where there was a rival Pope, and he thought he could unite Europe behind him if he could get the people involved in a great popular cause. This is a part of worldly wisdom. Governors or rulers who are under siege often try to focus people's attention on some enemy out there to get out of trouble themselves, and this seems to be part of his motivation. So in November of 1095, he preached a sermon in France, launching the first crusade, and I wanted to give you a sampling of that, page 207 and 8. I think Needham says something about this is one of the most effective sermons ever preached in the history of Christendom, but not in the gaining of salvation or moving people to holiness, but involving in this irrational, if you think about it, and wicked enterprise. But here's what part of what he says. He addresses the nation of the French. He says, "We address our sermon to you, for you our exhortations are intended. From Jerusalem and the city of Constantinople has gone forth a horrible tale which has often reached our ears. It is reported that a nation from the kingdom of the Persians, an accursed nation, a nation totally alienated from God," he means the Turks, "has violently invaded the lands of the Eastern Christians, reducing their population by plunder and by fire." It's interesting he calls them the Eastern Christians and not the Eastern heretics at this point. "They have taken away many captives to their own country and killed others by cruel tortures. They have destroyed God's churches and taken them over for the practice of their own religion. They destroy the altars after defiling them by their own uncleanness. For they force circumcision on the Christians and spread the blood of circumcision on the altars or pour it into baptismal vessels. Therefore, let hatred depart from among you. From among you, let your quarrels cease. Let wars end," he means among yourselves. "Let all contentions and controversies slumber. Set out on the road that leads to Christ's holy tomb. Seize that land from the wicked nation of Turks. Conquer it for yourselves." Scripture says that the land there is flowing with milk and honey, and that God gave it into the power of the children of Israel. Jerusalem is the center of the world. Its land is fruitful above all others, like another paradise of delights. Well, this is a piece of demagoguery. I've not been to the Holy Land. I've been to Europe. To say that land is more fertile than Europe seems to be, at least, unless it's changed a lot, unless there's been a lot of climate change since then, this is to paint a picture that is not in keeping with what is as real. So set out, seize this land from the wicked nation of the Turks. And then later, "This royal city, the center of the world, is now held captive by the enemies of Christ. It is subjected to those who do not know God and to their pagan worship. She seeks and desires her freedom," that is Jerusalem. "She does not cease to beg you to come to her aid. From you, above all, she asks for help, because God has bestowed on the French above all other nations great glory in warfare, as we have already said. So then, undertake this journey for the forgiveness of your sins with the assurance of imperishable glory in the kingdom of heaven." And the terrible analogy with jihad is really striking, isn't it? Different view of what heaven would be like, but to say a similar idea of the way to get there. So this is wickedness in my view. Well, the ones who did the fighting, for the most part, were from the feudal class that were called knights. They were the warriors, kind of a warrior class within feudalism, governed by the code of chivalry. And Needham gives a quote from an abbot by the name of Guibert, who says, Guibert, I suppose, in French, "God has instituted holy wars so that knights may find a new way of gaining salvation. And a plenary indulgence was granted to all who fought in the Crusades." Now, an indulgence, remember, is a reduction or paying off of the temporal punishment for sin that people owed before they could go to heaven. Plenary indulgence means full remission and immediate passage into heaven. And so that was a motivation for people to go. Probably also a more mundane thing, desire for land and gaining honor in battle was also played a part in this. Before what is listed as the First Crusade, there was a really tragic one called the People's Crusade. Later there was another called the Children's Crusade, in which a mob of peasants followed Peter the Hermit to almost total slaughter in Asia Minor. They were not military. They met with trained Turkish troops, and they were just slaughtered. And along the way, we are told they killed Jews. So here's an outbreak of anti-Semitism among these people. Needham calls it the first outbreak of violent anti-Semitism in medieval Europe. Well, the First Crusade itself, led by French and Norman nobles, an army of 300,000. I think Needham says by the time they were done, there were only 20,000 left. Think of that. Think of the mortality rate among those who went to fight this battle. They arrived in Constantinople in winter of 1096 and 97, defeated the Turks, captured Nicaea and Antioch, and ultimately Jerusalem in 1099, and they proceeded to kill all Jews and Muslims in the city of Jerusalem, men, women, and children. The result was that Asia Minor was restored to Byzantine rule, and four Crusader kingdoms were established in Syria and Palestine. Orthodox believers who were there were forced to become Catholic. Second Crusade from 1147 to 49, and this one involves Bernard of Clairvaux, so we spend some, give some attention to him. He really is a very puzzling figure to me, kind of a contradiction in terms. Because there are many things that are positive about the record of his life. He was the founder of a new monastery in Clairvaux in 1115, and then that became the mother monastery for quite a number of others. Finally, there was a total of 338 that came from that one monastery. Bernard was a very powerful leader, not only of his own monastic order, but in the church in general, by virtue of his great preaching and his wise counsel. But in the sort of contradictory aspect of this, as Needham describes it, he emphasized the love of God and the humanity of Christ, and also devotion to Mary. So it's not that he's a clear worshiper of Christ alone, but he's involved in this medieval devotion to Mary. He was asked by the Pope to promote a crusade after a victory by the Turks at Edessa, and he did that. So he preached in order to encourage people to go and to fight this crusade. And this crusade that Bernard promoted was a total failure. Well, let me go back for a moment to Bernard. The interesting thing about him, another of the puzzling things about it, is that he was spoken of very highly by both Luther and Calvin. If you look at Luther, at Calvin's Institutes and the footnotes, it's very often that he quotes Bernard of Clairvaux. To my knowledge, always positively, always as a kind of a model of a Christian minister of the word and teacher. Yet he was involved in this, what I regard as great wickedness in this Second Crusade. I tried a couple of years ago in connection with Rick Gamble. He and I were getting together regularly. We tried to read some of Bernard, and we got tired of it pretty soon. I didn't see what it was about him that Calvin was so deeply attracted to. But it's a fact we're dealing with historically, very highly regarded by the reformers. He spoke about love for neighbor, and then he promoted this slaughter of those who are sort of remote neighbors, but part of a different religion. Well, this crusade was a total failure, and the object of it to regain territory was not achieved, and what were left of these soldiers came home in humiliation. However, as a kind of byproduct, as Needham mentions, knights from England and Belgium who were on their way there conquered the city of Lisbon and founded the Kingdom of Portugal. And that later became important, of course, in exploration that led to the discovery of the New World. Third Crusade, this involved three royal figures, Philip Augustus of France, the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, and Richard I of England. And they were largely unsuccessful, although a peace treaty with the Turkish leader Saladin gave the Crusaders coastland from Acre to Ascalon with access to Jerusalem, and that's on the northwest coast of Palestine. Now, you know something about this crusade, whether you know that you know about it or not. You've read about it in novels. Do you know which ones? Not King Arthur. That's a different time period. Man, kids are not allowed to answer because I was asking about it this afternoon. Ivanhoe. The novel, Sir Walter Scott's novel, Ivanhoe, is set in this period. And King Richard the Lionhearted is this king that went to fight the crusade. Also, stories of Robin Hood. Prince John is the brother of King Richard, and King Richard is away fighting in the crusade, and Prince John is the wicked guy that's trying to take his place. And in the story, King Richard is the good guy. He's the good king and the good soldier. Well, he's the one who was involved in this crusade. On the way back, he was captured and held for ransom by, I think, by the Holy Roman Emperor. I've forgotten that detail. Again, on our trip, we drove along the Danube River, and we were shown up on a hillside. I have a picture of it, the castle where he was held prisoner while his captors sought for ransom. And there was a statue of King Richard right by the road there. Well, that's the Third Crusade. The Fourth Crusade, 1202 to 1204, proclaimed by Pope Innocent III, and a French army sought the aid of Venice, conquered a city in Dalmatia at the instigation of Venice, that was a city-state involved in trading and wanted to extend their territory. Because they had diverted from the Holy Land, the Crusaders were excommunicated. Later, the French were restored by the Pope, but not the Venetians. And along the way, Alexius Angelus engaged the Crusaders to gain the Byzantine throne for himself. So he wanted, this is an Eastern Orthodox guy. He wants to become the Eastern Emperor and sought the help of the Crusaders. And they helped him, but when he did not pay, then they turned on him and they conquered Constantinople, established there a Latin kingdom with a Catholic patriarch of Constantinople. So here are Roman Catholics. It's appropriate now to use that term, taking control of the center of Eastern Orthodoxy and establishing their Catholic churches. And so this turns into warfare among Christians, not between Christians and Muslims. And when Needham says, and I think this is right, the Fourth Crusade was one of the darkest episodes in Christian history. Well, what were the effects of the Crusades? One, in a worldly sense, and it has to be only in this sense, the prestige of the papacy was enhanced. Secondly, the granting of indulgences was enhanced and encouraged. Soldiers in the Crusades were granted indulgences. This is an increase in the practice of that. Third, holy war was made more acceptable, and Needham thinks this led to a climate in which later on groups like the Waldensians and the Albigensians would be the objects of other crusades, dissenting groups being suppressed by military power. Fourth, the power of the nobility was weakened, because in order to participate, their participation in the Crusades, they granted independence to towns and cities, and so they became like city-states. And the power of the nobles was decreased, and this created a situation in which kings could gather power to themselves. Fifth, the hostility between Catholics and Orthodox was increased because they were killing one another. And, of course, that increased their hostility. Six, Byzantium's ability to withstand Islam was weakened because they were defeated in battle by the Crusaders. And so this led to Muslim conquests in Eastern Europe. And finally, cruelty and intolerance were increased in Muslim-Christian relations. Needham says, to this day, Arabic and Turkish Muslims think of Christianity in terms of the Crusades. So this is a really tragic history, and I think it illustrates the folly of seeking to promote the kingdom of Christ by the sword. It's to be done by the power of the gospel, not by the weapons of the flesh.
Could you repeat the first of the message?
Of the effects? Okay. Number one is the increase of the prestige of the papacy. It might be ill-deserved, but that seemed to be the effect. They had the power to motivate people to go on these great crusades. Number six was that the Byzantine Empire's ability to withstand Islam was weakened because they lost militarily, and so they were less able to resist the Muslims who were advancing. And the Muslims went clear up the Danube to Vienna before they were stopped. At a later time, not right at this time. Questions or comments? When we think about warfare, people often go back to Augustine's just war theory, and I think it's a pretty solid theory about the conditions on which warfare is right. But I think it has to be said, after you talk about just war theory, not many wars have met the criteria that were set by Augustine, and which I think ultimately can be traced back to the scripture. So, as I said, it's distressing to read history because so much of it is a story of war. And I think it's a warning to us. We ought not to glorify war. Sometimes I believe it's necessary. But certainly it's not a way of promoting the gospel or making Christians of people. That's the power of the gospel, not the power of the sword. They weren't really trying to make people Christian. They were trying to recover territory. And there's no holy place since Christ has come, except in heaven, and we don't need to control territory in order to be properly devoted to Christ. Okay.